Hey, Prime members, you can listen to The Vanished ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today.
In our case, it's like he really did just vanish off the face of the earth, and there was really no clues left behind. There was, you know, nothing really to go on, and even the detectives and people that have, you know, investigated it, they're all kind of stumped, like, you know, well, why isn't there more? So that's kind of where we've been all these years. And of course, there's been, you know, rumors and speculation.
I'm not going to give up until I find him and know what happened to him. I want to know. I want to know where he is. I mean, if you have kids and something happens to one of them, you want to know where they're at and what's going on with them and why and all that. I want to know all these questions. I want answers to them.
20-year-old Keith Mann was last seen in Wichita Falls, Texas on Saturday, May 10th, 1997. Keith had worked that day and later went out with a couple friends. While they were hanging out, Keith mentioned that he was meeting someone at 12:15 a.m. His friends said that they dropped him off at his apartment at 11:45 p.m. They said they watched him walk up the stairs in the direction of his apartment, and that's the last time anyone claims to have seen Keith. The car that Keith had been driving was spotted the following day in a church parking lot near his parents' house, just a few miles away. Keith's disappearance is a baffling mystery with no obvious suspects to point to, no enemies, nothing to be running from. Keith has now been missing for 21 years, and in those 21 years, there just haven't been many solid leads. Keith's family isn't giving up, though. They still have hope that someday someone will come forward with the answers that they've been desperately searching for. I'm Marissa, and from Wondery, this is episode 128 of The Vanished, Keith Mann's story. Audible offers thousands of popular favorites, exclusive new series, guided wellness programs, comedy, and exciting new voices in audio. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. The Audible app makes it easy to listen anytime, anywhere. While traveling, working out, walking, doing chores, you decide. I like to listen a little bit each evening while I'm cooking dinner. And it's great for my evening walks, too. Recently, I've been listening to Lay Them to Rest by Laura Norton. It's a fantastic audiobook. You don't want to miss it. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/MIA or text MIA to 500-500. That's audible.com/MIA or text MIA to 500-500. Leading up to Keith's disappearance, things were going really well for him. Growing up, he had been a star baseball player and went on to play at college, but after a year, he decided that it just wasn't right for him. He ended up taking a job as a car salesman at Ron Roberts Ford in Wichita Falls. He loved this job. One thing about Keith's job that becomes important to this story later on is that the salesmen at Ron Roberts Ford were allowed to take cars home after work. So Keith was often seen driving different vehicles. He'd also recently gotten engaged. He and his fiance got an apartment together, and she was just about to move in once her college semester was over. But this is when Keith mysteriously vanished. I spoke to Keith's father, Greg, and his stepmom, Deborah, for this episode. They had contacted me because they're always trying to keep Keith's story out there. The passage of time has not made this any easier for them. As I mentioned, Keith had recently gotten engaged. His fiancée, Carrie, was in the process of moving into the apartment that they had rented together. Keith's stepmom, Deborah, spoke about this time.
Well, they had met in college. A junior college that's about an hour and a half away from us. And she was graduating that May. He had been living with us for a few months, and they wanted to get an apartment here because she was going to get a job here and live here. So he had gotten that apartment in April. So they only lived there about a month, and they were getting furniture. She'd come down on the weekends, you know, bring her belongings. So she was gradually moving in. The day that he comes up missing is when she was coming to live with him full time.
Deborah and Greg saw Keith the day before he disappeared. They were celebrating Carrie's graduation, and nothing appeared to be out of the ordinary.
The last time we saw him was his girlfriend was graduating May 9th. So we all went. We went out to dinner afterwards, met her family and all. And then when it was over, we kind of went our separate ways. They went on to Dallas, where they were staying for the weekend. And then we came back to Wichita Falls and in separate cars and all. So as we pass our street, you know, we turn off and Keith keeps going straight to his apartment and flashes his lights. And that's the last time we see him. So that's about, it was about midnight or maybe like 1 a.m.
This is what they've been able to piece together about May 10th, the last day that anyone ever saw Keith.
So then he works all day Saturday from probably about 8 or 9 a.m. till 9 p.m. So it's a good, you know, 12-hour day, works all day, comes home, and he's talking to his fiance on the phone about 9:30. And he says, yeah, you know, my friends, Chris and Michelle are going to come pick me up. We're going to go out for a couple hours. So they leave. They go to, they went to the FINA convenience store, which is actually right near our house. But they went there because that's the only credit card he had on him was his fiance's FINA card. So he didn't have any cash on him. So he used that to buy him some snacks, something for the night. I guess the friend who was older, he bought beer for them. They went to McDonald's to get some more food, and then went out to behind the, we have a big stadium here and there's some woods out there. And so they went out there to go mudding for about an hour. And that was also a loaner car from work. This guy also worked at Ron Roberts Ford. So they had to clean it up. So at the car wash, that's when Keith says, well, you need to drop me off. I've got to meet somebody at 12:15. And he didn't really say who it was or, you know, what it was about. And I guess they didn't ask. And so they dropped him off at 11:45. They saw him walk up. It was like two short flights of stairs up to the apartments, and it kind of turned. So they could only see him go up one flight of stairs, didn't see him go up the other one. So they never actually saw him enter the apartment. But we assume he got inside because the coworker friend said that, well, yeah, he took three beers with him. And those three beers were found on the counter. Two of them were full. One was about half empty. So he had drank some of it. So those were left there. And that's the last time. Them saying, well, we saw him go up the stairs at 11:45. That's the last time that it's been verified that anybody ever saw him.
And they were the last ones to see him.
Yeah.
As I mentioned, Keith was allowed to take cars home after work, so he wasn't always driving the same car. On the day of his disappearance, he had checked out a red Ford Mustang, but his family didn't know that. The Mustang was found in the parking lot of a church right by his parents' home.
His car ended up nearby our house, actually practically next door. We saw it the next day. We didn't know that that was his car at first, though, because the car that we saw him in Friday night was a white Escort. So we just assumed that's the car he had for the weekend. But I guess on Saturday when he worked, he chose another car. He took a red Mustang, which I had seen him drive that maybe once before. So, you know, it did look familiar to me when we walked out the door to go to church. And I just thought it was really odd. I was kind of like, wow, that's really weird that car's there. I said, but must be somebody from church test driving a car, you know, they're going to buy it or something. So it didn't really worry me a whole lot at that point. Well, when we got back from church, it's 12 o'clock. The church parking lot is completely empty, you know, except for this one car sitting there. And then I'm like, well, that's kind of odd that that's still sitting there.
Well, they had noticed the Mustang at the church. They hadn't yet realized that Keith was missing. It wasn't until his fiance called to ask if they had seen Keith.
At 1 o'clock, his girlfriend, fiance, she calls and says, well, is he over there with you or did he go to church with you? What's going on? We said, no, last time we saw him, you know, was you know, after the graduation and all, and didn't see him at all on Saturday. I said, well, hold on a minute. So I went and looked out the window, and the car is still sitting there. So I got back to her, and I'm like, well, you know, there's this red Mustang, Ron Roberts Ford Mustang, right near our house. I said, I wonder if that's, you know, the car Keith was driving. She said, okay, well, I came back into town about an hour early. We had said we were going to meet at 2 o'clock, and then we were going to come over to your house later that, you know, afternoon for, it was Mother's Day. So they were going to come over with some gifts and stuff. She said, this is really kind of odd. You know, I can tell he didn't spend the night here because his clothes from work are still laying on the bed. He, you know, hadn't slept in the bed. So, you know, something's going on. She says, I'll come over. So she came over and we just sat here and waited. And we thought, well, he's got to come back to get the car. Got to go to work on Monday. And we just sat here and tried to think of where he could be. And I think his fiance and I were pretty worried at right away. My husband was like, well, no, he's a guy, you know, he probably just went to the lake and just didn't tell anybody. And then they had car trouble or something, you know, something logical. I'm not too worried about it right now. But then when it started to get dark and he still no word from him, and we of course stayed up all night waiting and all that. And Monday morning, and he had to be to work like 8 a.m. and he still wasn't back to pick up the car. Then my husband agreed. He's like, no, something had to have happened. He would have been back to get his car. And
when Keith didn't show up for work on Monday, they knew something was seriously wrong. And that's when they decided to contact the police and file a missing persons report.
He really liked his job. He'd only been working there about not even maybe 2 months, but he really seemed to enjoy it. And he seemed like he liked that line of work, being a salesman. And so for him not to show up for work, then we thought that, okay, something's really got to be wrong. So that's when we filed the missing person report that morning. And we've just really been sitting here ever since, just waiting and waiting, and nothing, like I said, nothing much really to go on.
Going back to the car, when the car dealership opened on Monday morning, they were able to confirm that the red Mustang in the church parking lot had been the car that Keith took when he left work on Saturday. They checked the car to see if it held any clues.
Okay, so the car was locked. When we walked over to it, the trunk was just barely popped. You couldn't really tell, like just driving by, but when you walked up on it, you could tell it wasn't pushed all the way down. So we pulled up the lid and we looked inside, and it was empty. The only thing wrong with it is one of the side panels looked like it had been moved or pushed aside. It was kind of not, you know, where it was supposed to be. The car was locked up, so we couldn't get inside. We looked inside. It was completely clean, you know, nothing. And Keith was tended to be messy, you know. I would think there would be papers or Coke in the console or, you know, something, but it was absolutely clean. And we had called the dealership looking for a second set of keys because we wanted to get inside, thinking, well, maybe he left a note somewhere in it saying where he went or something. And they didn't have a second set, so they had to send out a locksmith, which it took them a few hours to get it keyed and all that.
Well, it didn't take them long to get in.
The ignition key.
It took about 4 or 5 hours for them to do an ignition key.
When they got it done, they sent a salesman out to drive it back to the dealership. And he told Chris, he said, well, it was really odd when I got in it. I didn't have to adjust the seat. And Keith is short. He is about 5'6". This guy must have been, you know, closer to
at least
six foot probably. So he noticed that, well, when he got in, he didn't have to adjust it at all, which he normally had to. Anytime he got into a car after Keith at the dealership, he had to adjust the seat. Well, he didn't have to that time. So he told that to Chris. Chris, of course, told us, and we called the locksmith and we're like, well, do you remember adjusting the seat or anything, moving it? And they said no, that they did not. So then that's when we kind of thought, well, maybe he didn't even drive it over here. Maybe somebody else drove it over here.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. When I walked up to that car, you couldn't tell it, but when you got close to the car, you could tell that the trunk was popped, and it was probably like about an inch. And then I lifted it up, and at the left-hand side of it, there was a panel that sits in there, and it was taken off, like the panel was taken off and somebody had gotten something out of that. And then I just shut that trunk lid back down. But see, that's another thing. We talk about that now. We shouldn't have shut the trunk down, you know, but you don't think of that at the time. There's just things we wished we had did that we didn't do and things like that. And if we could go back, we would know probably more information, you know.
One of the mysteries of this case is why the Mustang ended up at the church. Did Keith set up a meeting with someone there? It is a place that Keith was familiar with since it was so close to his parents' home. Or did someone else drive the car there and abandon it? Greg and Deborah spoke about the distance between Keith's apartment and their home.
With no traffic lights, 10 minutes maybe. He wasn't that far.
Yeah, maybe not even that much. And it's a pretty straight shot down Southwest Parkway. Now, my daughter did hear a noise about 1:15 in the morning. That would have been on Sunday morning. She thought she heard some kind of car noise, but she just assumed, oh, okay, well, it's somebody from the church. She didn't think much of it, didn't look out the window or anything. And then my husband gets up early, so he probably got the paper probably, I don't know, 5-6 in the morning, and he saw it out there, but he doesn't remember ever Keith driving that particular car before. I do, and Keith must have came over sometime when my husband was at work. I recognized it right away. Greg wasn't real sure about it. He just saw it, and we've seen cars there over the years, so it didn't surprise us or anything. But so we're thinking it's sometime, like I said, if he dropped it off about 1:15 or somebody else, it had to have been about that time period, you know, that something happened to him between 1 and, maybe 5 in the morning, something like that.
The location of the car is something that they continue to go over in their minds. If he didn't want to meet someone at his own place, why not pick someplace closer to his apartment, like a restaurant or a store parking lot?
The only thing we could think of at that point, if he brought the car over here, he didn't want whoever he was meeting to know he lived in them apartments. That's the only thing we can come up with. Why would he bring the car over here?
Everyone was trying to figure out where Keith could be. The timing of his disappearance being so close to when his fiancée was moving into their apartment initially made his family wonder if he just had second thoughts about their relationship.
In my mind, the most logical thing sounded like, oh, well, he must have gotten cold feet. Maybe he wasn't, ready to have a live-in girlfriend. They had just gotten engaged. Maybe he didn't want to get married. He just didn't know how to tell her. So he just took off, went to his mom's house, and we'll hear something in a couple of weeks, something like that. I think that's the majority probably maybe thought that, well, that's kind of strange, but sometimes guys get cold feet and break off the engagement or whatever. But if that didn't make sense after, a few days, a week, no calls. He had a lot of family members in different states. If he didn't want to call us for some reason, he had a grandmother, mother, cousins. There was a lot of people he could have contacted, and there was absolutely no contact after the 10th at all.
On the evening of Keith's disappearance, one place we know that he had been was to a convenience store. The police were able to get the surveillance tape from the store, and they showed it to his family.
We could see him looking like his normal self.
Yeah.
He looked happy, didn't look nervous, anxious, worried, nothing, He just seemed like his regular self.
And he liked that job. I know he would have been back Monday morning, even if he didn't show up till then. If he was out partying or something like that, he would have been back. He sold two cars, a car and a half Saturday, and he was up, just like she said, he looked pretty happy and all that kind of stuff. It tells me he was going to go back Monday and never got the opportunity.
We all know there are things in life that you have to compromise on, but when it comes to your health, there's no compromise. So don't settle for that one doctor that isn't really addressing your needs. Instead, check out ZocDoc, the place where you can find and book doctors who will make you feel comfortable. And you can even search by location, availability, and insurance. ZocDoc is a free app and website where you can search and compare highly rated in-network doctors near you and instantly book appointments with them online. Once you find the doc you want, you can book them immediately. You can filter specifically for ones who take your insurance, are located near you, and treat basically any condition you're searching for. The typical wait time to see a doctor booked on ZocDoc is between just 24 and 72 hours. That's it. I use this and you should too. Go to ZocDoc.com/vanished and download the ZocDoc app for free. Then find and book a top-rated doctor today. That's ZocDoc.com/vanished. ZocDoc.com/vanished. This message is sponsored by Greenlight. When you're a parent, you'll have your fair share of big talks with your kids. One of those big talks should involve money, and Greenlight can help with that. Greenlight is a debit card and money app for families. You can send your kids instant money transfers, get real-time notifications of spending, manage chores, and automate allowance. I've been using Greenlight with my older two kids for years. One thing that I love about it is that I can set up recurring or one-time chores, customized to my family's needs, and then my kids earn an allowance to reward them for a job well done. Not only does it motivate them to actually get the chores done, but it also teaches them a bit about financial literacy and independence. They're learning to earn, save, and spend wisely. So stop putting off the money talk and start putting your kids on the right path. Sign up for Greenlight today and get your first month free at greenlight.com/vanished. That's greenlight.com/vanished to try Greenlight for free. One more time, that's greenlight.com/vanished. Keith's apartment didn't really offer many clues to what may have happened either.
Keith left all of his personal belongings behind. He had paychecks coming to him Monday. My son wanted his money, so he would have went and got that money Monday. He didn't even have a quarter, Chris said, to call Saturday night when they went out to make this phone call to whoever he was supposed to meet. So
if he was just going to leave, he would wait to get his money or, you know,
take some of his clothes with him, yeah. Something. He left everything behind.
It looked like, if you walked into his apartment, it looked like someone dropped the beers off on the counter and then turned around and went back out, but expected to come back, you know, pretty quick after that. So that's how it looked to us.
That's where we're at. That's why we're having so much problems, because when they believe what Chris says, we can go into 10, 15 different things that could have happened to Keith. I'm just saying, somebody knows what Keith is or what happened to him. Someone has to know.
One thing in Keith's apartment that his father, Greg, has always wondered about were those three beers on the counter.
Going back to the three beers, that's why I'm trying to tell you that when Chris makes the comment to the police that Keith got out of that car that night when he dropped him back off and he took three beers with him, well, when you walk into the apartment, well, there's those three beers right there on that counter. So, well, oh, okay. Chris, you're telling us the truth. There's them beers right there on that counter. Well, why weren't they put in the refrigerator, you know? Like you said, you had two full ones and then one that was about half drank. So it just makes me wonder why they're sitting there. When you're out drinking and stuff, it looked to me like they only bought 1 6-pack. They're out for a couple hours. Well, each of them, there were three of them. You would think each of them would drink more than one beer.
When Greg and Deborah were telling me about the apartment, I was curious to find out if it had ever been forensically searched.
No, I don't think they did.
I'm pretty sure the detectives, you know, went over there, looked around, saw that no signs of struggle. And like I said, it truly did look like he was coming back within the hour. It didn't look like, okay, you know, bags packed or things a mess or anything like that. So, and of course, I'm sure you've heard, in the beginning, unless you have some kind of hard evidence, they tend to not take it too seriously just because when you're an adult, you know, you're allowed to leave, you're allowed to go. You don't have to tell your mom and dad where you're going or, you know, whatever. So, you know, they don't want to put a lot of resources into it if it's just a case of someone that just took off for whatever reason. So I think the first couple of weeks, it kind of was not taken too seriously. It wasn't until a good few months went by with absolutely nothing.
Other residents of Keith's apartment complex were interviewed, and they have had consistent stories about what they did and didn't hear the night that he disappeared.
they say they heard him being picked up by Chris with the music and all that. But when they dropped him off, like Chris and them claim they dropped him off, nobody ever heard him come back. That's what they say. So I don't know.
There was one woman who lived in the complex who remembered something that happened before he went missing. Something that she thought could be important.
He lived upstairs, so she was right across from him. I think there were like two or three apartments upstairs like that across and all. But anyway, she said that at the laundromat there at the apartment complex, she thought it was my son and another guy with a mean-looking face, and they were arguing right there at the laundromat. And my son only was there for about a month, so it had to be within the last week or two of his disappearance that happened. But we've tried to check that out too, and that we never did find out if that was even him or who it was, you know. So
no one has been able to establish if it was really Keith having an argument or who the other man may have been, so this story still lingers. This is the thing about Keith. They haven't been able to identify any enemies that he may have had.
No, he didn't have any enemies. Anybody that you talk to, they're like, well, he was a really nice, polite guy. You know, not that we know of that he had problems with anybody, or he seemed to get along with everybody at work. And he didn't have a whole lot of friends. He'd been gone. He'd went to college at the same place where he met his fiance. He'd been gone for like a year or so. And we really didn't know any of the friends there. But when he moved back here, he was mainly just working. So he really wasn't seeing a lot of people that he used to know in high school or anything like that. So like I said, just a couple of work buddies, but he didn't seem to have any problems with anybody. And that's what's kind of weird. It's like, you know, well, did he see something that he wasn't supposed to see or know something? I mean, people have said, well, maybe he's in the, what is that, federal witness protection plan, you know, deal, or like, well, no, I don't think so. I mean, there was no trials going on. He wasn't supposed to testify, you know, nothing like that. But I mean, it was just so odd, and nobody knew exactly what was going on. So.
And back then I had the bus station here in Wichita Falls. So when all this happened, I knew the taxi drivers, most of them. The airport here closed like at 11:30, 12 o'clock at night. I checked all that out. The taxi, the bus, which yeah. I know all the bus drivers, where they got on a bus or not. And I didn't find out anything like that. And I don't think he would have walked up here to the expressway and hitchhiked out of town.
In an attempt to find more information, they spoke to the neighbors around the church to see if they had seen or heard anything that night.
If Chris did drop him off, and let's say Keith did drive this car back here, we don't even know if it was him, because nobody saw him get out of that car, even our neighbors around here. I talked to all them neighbors, and I know them. I've lived here in this house for over 30 years. So back then, the neighbors, we talked to them. Nobody saw him get out of his car. So we don't even know if he drove the car here, whether he left with somebody, he drove the car, or someone else drove it. That's the thing maybe that we could have known, you know. My wife stays up late at night. I go to bed early. So I just wish we'd have known that. Or my daughter looked out the window, you know, and saw it was him, you know, and somebody was over here picking him up or something like that, but nothing like that.
We know that when someone goes missing, those who are close to them or the last to have seen them are always looked at. Since the car was found so close to his parents' home, they did investigate his family in order to clear them of any suspicion. They also looked at his friend Chris, since he and his girlfriend were the last known people to see Keith. Keith and Chris had become friends while working at Ron Roberts Ford. They were close in age and developed a friendship at work. The police don't consider Chris a suspect or person of interest, but Greg has some lingering questions.
I know Chris passed polygraph test, and I believed that he was telling the truth at first. We were lost on all this when this all happened, but if we could go back and kind of like be how we are now, back to that point in 97, we would have asked a lot more questions of Chris and I still would like to talk to Chris. I would like to ask him some questions. We can't get no contact with him. Go back to the beginning of it. Someone has to know where Keith is. Someone has to know where he took off. Someone has to know whether something happened to him. And that's the problem with it. No one wants to say what happened, whether he took off or not. We have not a large reward out for him. We have reward out for him. Well, nobody wants to come forward and say, oh, yeah, I saw Keith over here, or take us to him, leave us to him, get a reward to show where he's at. Nobody says anything. When we talk about Chris, when he's at the car wash from his apartment is only, it's a short distance, let's say a couple blocks. Well, they're washing the car after they went mudding. Okay. Well, I know it's not Chris's vehicle, and he doesn't want to be caught by the owner cleaning up the vehicle that he went mudding in this vehicle. It's not his. But what I can't figure out when they're at the car wash and Keith makes this comment, oh, I got someone to meet at midnight, at 12:15, and he doesn't have a quarter. Why didn't Chris just take him back to his apartment and let him call? I can't understand that. I never questioned him. Well, what do you mean he had someone to meet at midnight and he didn't have a quarter? I mean, did he just randomly tell you that or what? But we never asked him.
Chris is the person who was told the story about Keith saying he was going to meet someone later that night at 12:15. No one else has ever stated that Keith had mentioned to them that he planned on meeting up with someone later that night.
Not that we're aware of. He never told anybody else.
That's Chris's story.
That's just what they were saying to us. Finally, we're able to contact him. Well, being Mother's Day, and like I said, with no cell phones, just calling his apartment phone. We didn't get a hold of him all day until that evening. And then he said, well, we had been gone visiting our mothers, for Mother's Day or whatever.
The police do believe Chris because I've asked them over and over, and they've had, like I told you, 3, 4, 5 people, different investigators investigating it. And they say Chris's story hasn't changed. We watch a lot of these TV shows and all that, crime shows. And these people that have done something to somebody, they're believable. And then once they got them with some evidence or something, then they'll confess, some something. But I know someone knows where my son's at.
He did take a lie detector test. He passed, so they're not considering him a suspect. But that's the last people that had contact with him.
I would still like to ask Chris a few more questions. And I'm not saying he's not telling the truth, but somebody knows where Keith is or what happened to him. Don't you agree with that? Someone has to know.
Even though Chris isn't in contact with Keith's family, he has been open to speaking with the police, even in recent years.
They went and talked to him again about 2 years ago. I talked to the detective, and they tend to believe what Chris has said because he didn't change his story or anything like that. But he does not live here in Wichita Falls. He's by Austin. My daughter has tried to make contact with him, but he doesn't contact her back. Yeah, I still want to talk to him. Of course I do.
Chris's girlfriend, Michelle, was also with them that night. Her stories were consistent with his. Over the years, Keith's family has lost touch with her also.
My wife did not actually track her down, but her and Chris are no longer together. She's in, Oklahoma or somewhere like that, but they're divorced. Chris is remarried now. So no, we haven't actually talked to her.
If the story about the meeting at 12:15 a.m. is true, another source of frustration is that they've never been able to identify who he would have been meeting.
And no person has ever come forward to say, oh, hey, that was me. I'm the one meeting them. Whether maybe they're afraid, well, then I'm going to get blamed for it, or there really wasn't a meeting. We don't know.
Another person close to Keith was his fiancée, Carrie. Since she hadn't officially moved in, she wasn't there daily to know everything that was going on, and she wasn't there the night that he disappeared. Just like everyone else in this story, she too was completely baffled by his disappearance.
She stayed here for maybe a week or two after Keith's disappearance. She stayed here at this house, not at that apartment. She was scared over there. So she stayed here. Her parents came down and got her and moved her back to El Paso. And we stayed in contact with her. She wrote a couple letters or something like that. And then probably about, I'd say maybe 6 months, maybe a year or something like that. And then
we just kind of lost contact. And
we've been trying to get a hold of her. I've asked the detective for her number. He can't give me that information. We've tried. I've tried to call her again.
The old numbers we had, you know, were non-working, or tried to message on Facebook, but no response, or, you know, things like that. So we've just, you know, we really would like to talk to everybody again, you know, now that it's been so long, and just pick everybody's brain about what they knew or what they thought back then. Because like I said, we were in such a fog that first few months that I know she stayed with us for 2 weeks, and I'm sure we had a lot of talks during that 2 weeks that she was here, but trying to think back on everything she said, it's kind of hard. And you don't expect it to last this long. I mean, most people, you think, okay, well, it's logical. Okay, maybe a month, maybe 6 months sounds okay. But to keep going years and years and years with nothing, you don't think that's going to happen. And you don't think to write everything down or to ask, you know, certain questions and stuff. So it's just, I feel like, you know, we made some mistakes at the beginning, just not being aware of, you know, really what to do, that we wish we could go back and change. But it's kind of hard now trying to play catch up 21 years later, just because a lot of people have moved out of town. Of course, the apartment was gone after when she moved out. Everything's gone. The car's gone. The apartment's gone. The fiance's gone.
Since Keith didn't have a cell phone, I thought, what about a home phone? Could his phone bill have had a clue to who he may have spoken to around the time of his disappearance?
We checked all that. The detective, Carrie, it was under her name. So when she left, I had to have her write a letter back to us and authorize them to do that. But that was never checked out. As far as the bill and all that, I don't know. Maybe Carrie had got it. We never received that. If it was a local call, it wouldn't be on there anyway. It'd have to be long distance.
Just long distance.
The other little clue that I was thinking about was the cassette tape that was left in the Mustang. Did that belong to Keith, or could it have belonged to someone else? Was it music that Keith even listened to?
The police supposedly have it. We asked them about that, and they can't find it.
At the time when we listened to it, it was just, we don't know which one. I just have in my notes a rock tape. I don't think there was anything on there, any kind of message or anything. His mom was asking about that the other day. She's like, well, I really like to listen, you know, maybe even some of the lyrics, you know, could give you a clue or something, but it hasn't been able to be found.
Most of the cases you hear about on the show, there are plenty of rumors, and it can be hard to tell if there's any truth to those rumors. Sometimes cases are solved and the answers fit the rumors that had been circulating, and other times they were completely off. There have been plenty of rumors about what happened to Keith, like biker gangs, drugs, and gambling, but never any evidence that he was involved with those things.
We've heard everything. In fact, one of the podcasts I was listening to, they mentioned Mexican mafia. Well, that was one of the theories, you know, that floated around town, even to the weird. Oh, aliens took him or something. But there's never really been any, like, hard facts that we know of. And the police have been really good about talking to us and, you know, letting us know what's going on. But like I said, there's been very few leads. The leads they do get turn out to be nothing. It's like, oh, somebody heard it from somebody at a party that heard it from their sister's best friend. And, you know, and then by the time you track it all down, it turns out, well, someone was just talking big or something. So nothing's ever come of any of the small leads that there was out there at the very beginning. And then, of course, over the years, it just seemed like everything just kind of dried up.
Everyone has their own opinions on psychics, and I respect that. I'm a skeptic myself. The thing is, though, when someone goes missing, often families are contacted by psychics. And even if it goes against their personal beliefs, out of desperation, sometimes they feel compelled to at least check it out. Because what if?
I don't believe in psychics, so I think his fiance first did it, So we started doing that too. And you're not supposed to do that, the Bible says, you know. But anyway, we did it. You do anything that you think that's going to help find him. But when I got off work, my wife and myself, we had a psychic from Colorado using dowsing rods. And I sent him a surveillance map of Wichita Falls. And he told us to go to this area and 6.1 to 6.3 miles out and look for him on the side of the road. So every morning when I get off work, we used to go out there and look. You don't know how that gets onto your mind to thinking, oh, I'm going to find my son or out there and, you know, some animals got a hold of him or something. And man, it drive you nuts. I mean, just the things you think of and just everything that goes on with it. And it's something else. And it still is. But like I say, with the Lord's help, I'm going to find him. I'm pretty negative. And within the last, I don't know, this detective took the case over within the last 2 or 3 years, I've been positive. We're going to find him somewhere. We're going to know possibly where he's at or something. We haven't found out yet, but maybe we will. I hope so. I think we will.
Several years after Keith went missing, a team of investigators reviewed his case, hoping that a fresh set of eyes could see something that no one else had picked up on yet.
In 2002, we actually got lucky in that here in Texas, there was a special deal going on where they picked, it was 20 cases a year where they would give you special investigators. We had a Texas Ranger and a Texas Department of Public Safety officer work on it for like a whole year. It was like kind of like a grant that they had gotten. And so they worked on it. They said two criteria that had to be met was one, the police had to be willing to work with them. And two, it had to be, you know, suspicion of foul play or something like that. So that's how the police have been looking at it, is more or less foul play, not that he just took off. So they went back from like square one, just talked to everybody involved again, tried to get more names from each person they talked to. They tried to get, you know, several more people that they can talk to. So then they go talk to those people, try to get more names. And so they went through the whole thing, pretty much said the same thing, that, yeah, there really isn't much to go on and we don't know what else we can do. They did find the car, the red Mustang, which, of course, like I said, was a dealership car that had gotten sold a couple of weeks after Keith came up missing. Well, they tracked it down in Dallas, I believe, and they went and did testing on it. And
luminol testing.
Nothing showed up.
And what they needed to do was actually do that same testing on the car that Keith was in with Chris. They never did that, but we were pushing them to do the car that was found over here, but nothing was found and it was clean.
Greg and Deborah have spent all of these years going over everything they know, trying to figure out what may have happened to Keith.
When all this happened, me and my wife would walk around the school. We lived by a school. We would not argue, I guess, but we would have conflict. She would be telling me, oh, I think he took off. But after the fact, he never showed back up. I said, no, something happened to him. I have a gut feeling something did happen to him.
And we've just tried over the years to try to understand and make things fit, but we're missing big pieces of the puzzle. So, you know, you could get one theory to fit, but then you start thinking, well, no, that really doesn't make sense. But you can make it fit if you want to, if you talk about it long enough. But we don't, you know, we don't know what he was thinking, you know, what he was doing at the time.
Since there are really no strong leads in Keith's case, it's hard to even know where to begin to look. When you examine the circumstances, you can start going in so many different directions. Was he really meeting someone? Did he drive his car to the parking lot, or did someone plant it there as a red herring? Deborah and Greg go back and forth on the car.
See, that's where we run into problems, my wife and myself. She thinks that Keith drove it over here from his apartment. This is where we have conflict. Yeah. Not a conflict, but disagree. I think he did not.
And the reason I do is because even when I walked out that first morning, it was parked exactly in the same spot where he used to park his car when he was in high school. He did used to park there. But the
preacher didn't want him to park there no more.
Yeah, we had a new preacher.
He told him not to park
there. He said, well, we need that space because we have a church van now. And, you know, we really appreciate it if you don't take up that spot. So he knew he wasn't supposed to. But then I thought, well, maybe that's a clue. He's parking it there to say, well, if I don't come back and get this car, then you know something's wrong. Because if it had been over to his apartment, you know, we may not have known for, you know, several days that something was up. But the car being here, and like I said, I feel like it was almost directly over his old oil spots from his old car that he drove in high school. So that's why I thought. But then when the saying that, well, the seat was pushed back, well, then we're like, well,
maybe,
you know,
he didn't drive.
Maybe he didn't drive it. Maybe it's just a coincidence that it's in that same exact spot. So, yeah, like I said, so we've gone back and forth. Like I said, every piece of information we have, you can go either way with it. Yeah. And
then the problem with it is you try to, you think, oh, yeah, that's who did this. So, and then you focus on them and you think, oh, no, there's something else. You find that out. No, it's them over here. And then you go back over here. No, it's them.
Yeah.
And then try not to accuse somebody and say something. Well, you're the ones responsible for his disappearance.
One theory that's been tossed around is whether or not Keith could have willingly walked away from his life.
We really don't know whether he took off. But I hope he did. But I know my son, I don't think, 21 years and nothing.
And being only, he had just turned 20. So,
yeah, just turned 20.
Not like he had a lot of life experience. He wasn't really street smart, you know. So to be out there on his own, surviving all these years, seems almost impossible to believe that he could have pulled that off.
I was telling my wife when we walk around that school that if he doesn't show back up in a month or two, something happened to him. It had to have, because he would have been found. His ID was flagged and all that. So he would have gotten in trouble. Something would have happened. Something would have gave where we could have found him and known where he's at.
It's often hard to imagine why someone would walk away from their own life when there isn't an obvious reason why. We know that he didn't have any known enemies and things were going well for him. But the reality is that some people do just walk away.
We actually had two cases here locally of young men about his same age, maybe a little older, that left, kind of assumed the same thing. Something happened to them. And then they found them in another state somehow. Either they contacted the parents or somehow, you know, the police found out. So I think that's what they think. Oh, okay. Well, here's just another case of someone took off, you know, they'll contact their family when they're ready. You just don't go 21 years with no contact. And we didn't have anything going on like within our family for him not to contact us. As far as we knew, like I said, everything was going good for him. I had a ton of dreams that he was alive, of course, but he was like in a barracks type situation, or, you know, a lot of bunk beds. Like I thought, well, maybe he's in a cult or something, or I couldn't quite figure it out. But all my dreams were positive, and we always, you know, he would like walk in the door and we'd be like, well, where have you been? You know, we've been looking for you, you know. And then he was his 20-year-old self, you know, not, you know, as the years went by, he didn't age in my dreams. But so I was trying to be more positive. I was trying to keep my husband from having a nervous breakdown. So I was trying to say, oh, yeah, you know, he just took off. He'll call us. He's fine. You know, don't worry about it. But he would have the opposite. He'd have bad dreams, like, you know, something bad had happened, or just his gut feelings that something's terribly wrong. And so we've kind of disagreed over the years. But, you know, it was me just trying to keep him positive, not because I thought, well, there's no sense thinking something bad happened to him unless you know the facts. Because here he could be so upset and, you know, mourning all these months. And then here he walks in the door, or here we get a phone call from California or something that he was spotted there or something. So I was just trying to keep him positive, but we go back and forth. It's like just trying to figure it out. It's just driven us crazy over all these years. Like, we just one day we'll have talk about one theory, and like I said, we try to make the pieces fit, and then the next day maybe we'll have a dream or have a thought that we're like, no, I think
I think maybe it went this way or something, you know. So we've changed. We go back and forth, kind of settle on maybe one or two that might be. And it's just, believe me, it's like the hardest thing you can go through of not knowing. And then you tend to probably make things worse in your mind. Like you think of all the terrible things that could have happened, or, you know, it was real hard at first, like watching any movie at the beginning of, you know, anybody being kidnapped or killed or anything like that, because you think, oh my gosh, that's maybe what happened to Keith. It's just really been hard on us mentally, just trying not to think the worst, but and trying to stay positive.
You know, just like you said earlier, it's not knowing. That's also the key to it, is not knowing where he is or what happened to him. And that's what you think every day. Well, is he going to come home, or were they going to find some remains somewhere?
You do have to question, if Keith did walk away, how likely is it that he still hasn't turned up after 21 years?
Well, see, the detective also told me that if he were to do that, walk away, he would have to be with someone older that knew what they were doing. He couldn't do it that age at 20, young 20.
And it seems like a lot of people that do end up getting found or caught, like if they were wanted by the police or something, is after several years, then they kind of start showing like a paper trail, or their name gets out there somehow, because I guess after a while you get kind of tired of doing that, and, you know, you forget. But like I said, in his case, like Social Security numbers never been used, driver's license never renewed or anything. Nothing since that day. Like I said, he had his fiance's FINA credit card with him. It was used, you know, that night at 10 o'clock, and that's the last time it was ever used. And, you know, that his wallet's never been found, the keys to the car, I mean, nothing. And, you know, there really, back then, there wasn't these big, you know, massive searches like what they do now and stuff. I mean, us as a family and a few friends, you know, we would go out to some areas where we thought he might possibly have been taken or something. And, you know, we were just hoping to, you know, to find, you know, the baseball cap he was wearing that night, or his wallet, you know, something that we could tell the police, oh, hey, you know, you really need to look in this area. You know, we found this here, you know, and we just never could find anything. And we scoured several different areas. But again, like I said, there was nothing concrete to say, okay, he went to this area, or he was seen walking in this area, or anything like that. So we were just kind of going off gut feelings. And like I said, maybe one of these psychics or something might have said an area or something.
The Vanished is sponsored by BetterHelp. With social gatherings picking up after the winter, it can be easy to ignore your social battery and spread yourself thin. It's a good time to think about the right amount of socializing for you. Maybe you thrive around people, or maybe you prefer more alone time. Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. A therapist can help you learn how to set boundaries so you feel empowered to be the best version of yourself. Everyone can benefit from therapy. It's not just for those who've experienced major trauma. So, if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, so it's designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist, and switch therapists anytime for no additional charge. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/vanished today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/vanished.
In 2015, an 18-year-old named Caleb Deal disappeared from Nocona, Texas. Many people believe that a man named Ricky Dale Howard is responsible for Caleb's disappearance. Caleb was working for Howard at the time and was last seen driving Howard's truck, which later reappeared at Howard's residence. But Caleb was never seen again. Howard is considered a person of interest in Caleb's case, and while they were investigating, two men came forward stating that Howard had sexually assaulted them when they were teens back in the 90s, back around the same time that Keith went missing. After this news broke, Greg has been trying to find any information that could possibly link his son to Ricky Dale Howard. Could this have been the person that Keith was supposed to meet that night?
This is a young man, 18 years old, when he disappeared. He lives in Nocona, Texas. Nocona, Texas, from Wichita Falls, is probably 40, 50 miles. Well, he disappears, like my son. No one knows where he's at and all. Caleb's parents blame this man named Ricky Dale Howard. He's a businessman there in Nocona. He's in prison right now. Second time he's been in prison. This time he's in it for firearms. But they just got some more charges against him on abusing children and all. So he's got to go to court on all that. So he's in prison. When my son got our scholarship in baseball, he went to Gainesville, Texas. So he would drive to Gainesville out of Wichita Falls. Well, Wichita Falls, to get to Gainesville, you go through Nocona. See, this is another crazy theory that I thought of. Well, maybe this Ricky Dale Howard knew my son, and I'm trying to find out about that also. Because back then in 97 is when all this abuse went on with these two younger guys, or of course they're older now, but my son come up missing in 97, and this was in the 90s. 95, 98, somewhere around in there. He was like president of the Bowie Bank. And then, like I say, he was a businessman there in Nocona. And my son used to stop there in Nocona sometimes, like at the Dairy Queen or something like that. I'm just wondering if you ran into this guy. I know it's crazy, but I'm trying to think of everything, you know. But I put the police on that also. We went to Nocona, let's say 2 years back, a year, whatever. We put flyers up in Nocona about my son there, you know, with Caleb's case. Keith may have ran into him. This guy may have known him. I don't know, you know, so.
While there's nothing to directly link Howard to Keith, we do know that Howard was allegedly abusing teens in the 90s. And I say allegedly because his charges are still pending for those cases. We also know that he's a person of interest in the disappearance of an 18-year-old just a few years ago. Keith had just turned 20 before he disappeared. I'd be interested to see if anyone could find any information linking Keith to Ricky Dale Howard. Even as recent as last year, they got a tip about a homeless man that someone thought was Keith.
Last year, there was at the 20-year anniversary, when we had posted on his Facebook page, somebody had said, well, he looks like this homeless man that's been in Amarillo for years and years. And Amarillo's only about 4 hours from us. So, and that's going out west where he's got family. His mom and their family lived there in New Mexico. And he kind of was one of those kids that came up here in the summers or school vacations and lived with her full time. But in high school, he decided to come and live with us permanently and go to high school here. But so we thought, well, that's logical. You know, maybe he was going back west and somehow maybe he got hit over the head in Amarillo and, you know, lost his memory, been homeless for years and years and years. But so we spent the majority of last year checking that out, but actually, of course, came out to be not Keith.
Back in 1997, only about 36% of households had home computers. I asked Deborah and Greg, and they said that Keith did not have one. Deborah explained how she's seen the rise of social media help in other missing persons cases.
And, you know, there wasn't Facebook. We didn't even have an email account. I can remember my sister coming up, setting me up. She was more of a computer nerd, so she set us up with an email so that I could start, you know, emailing different websites or different agencies, you know, trying to get help. So, yeah, there was really no technology back then. And now it's so easy to trace the cell phone calls or find, you know, where the cell phone was right before it turned off or something like that. So it's easier to track down people. But we had none of that to go on. It was a different world 20 years ago when you were trying to find your missing loved one. And now it's been about 5-6 years, Our daughter is a graphic design artist, and for her senior project, she asked her teacher if she could build a website concerning her missing brother and got the okay on that. So she went ahead and she did the missingmanproject.com, got that started, and then also the Facebook page, which, you know, that's helped, makes it a lot easier to spread awareness. And, you know, now I see all these, I share all these cases, see them all come in, and, you know, it's just so easy to spread it nationwide, which we were trying to do it the old-fashioned way, you know, mailing flyers, you know, having to call different states we thought he might be in, you know, calling the hospitals, calling the homeless shelter, you know, just calling all over. So it was a lot different, and it made it harder. I wish we had all the technology now. I think it would have been solved.
So what happened to Keith Mann on May 10th, 1997? We know that he worked that day and then hung out with some friends that evening. They have him on video buying some snacks, and his friend purchased beer. His friends claim that they went mudding, then to a car wash, where Keith mentioned needing to call someone. He was supposed to be meeting someone at 12:15 a.m. His friends said they dropped him off at his apartment and saw him heading up the steps. After that, Keith was never seen or heard from again. The three beers that his friends said he took with him were found on the counter inside the apartment. The next morning, his family noticed a red Mustang parked in the church parking lot by their home. When we talk about theories in this case, you have to wonder if he drove the Mustang there himself or if it was planted there by somebody else. The driver's seat was pushed all the way back, but Keith was a short guy. Chris was taller, but why would Chris notify Keith's parents about the seat if he had something to do with his disappearance? And why was the trunk of the Mustang open? And what about that panel inside being moved? If Keith was meeting someone, who was it? Who would he have been meeting at 12:15 a.m.? If he didn't drive the car there, who did and why did they leave it there? If it was someone else who drove it there, you'd think that it had to have been someone who knew Keith well enough to know that his family lived right by the church. As Greg and Deborah have said, all of these questions can make you crazy, going down a different rabbit hole for each little possibility. His family has spent the past 21 years looking for answers, and because of this, they haven't had a chance to mourn.
And like I said, and it's been hard for the whole family because, yes, you know, we had two young daughters and we weren't able to mourn as if, you know, if he'd been in a car wreck or something, that would have been different. You know, we would have known, we would have mourned. I think they'd have been better off emotionally and psychologically and all that. But just to not know all these years what happened to their brother and what kind of danger may be out there or something, it's just, you know, it's been really hard on just the family and just how everything changed. We're kind of stuck back in 1997, kind of in a way that it's hard for us to just get over it.
They did this age progression picture on my son 2 years ago. Well, when they sent it to us, we opened the envelope up and I said, "That's not my son." I looked at it and I said, "That's not him." And Debbie said the same thing. So I was telling the detective, and I talked to him quite a bit. And I said, you know, if I saw my son and I passed him at the age he is right now, I wouldn't even recognize him. He doesn't even look the same.
And in our mind, he's still 20 years old. That's how we remember him. And, of course, the last pictures that were taken of him and stuff, you know, was between 18 to 20. So that's, in our mind, he's still that age. It's, when you don't see somebody aging and growing up, it's hard to imagine them that old. But he had a very distinct walk and body style. He was short, but he was stocky and athletic. So I feel like we would recognize him more off of that. But he had really pretty eyes, long eyelashes, you know, things like that wouldn't change. But yeah, it's really hard looking at the age progression pictures just because it just doesn't feel real to us, like that's what he could look like.
That brings us to the end of episode 128. If you have any information about the disappearance of Keith Mann, please contact Crime Stoppers at 800-322-9888. You can also contact the Wichita Falls Police Department at 940-761-7762. If you'd like to follow this case on Facebook, just search for The Missing Man Project. And they also have a website, themissingmanproject.com. I'd like to point out that man is spelled with two N's, just like Keith's last name. I'd like to thank Greg and Deborah for taking the time to speak with me for this episode. If you have a missing loved one that you'd like to have featured on the show, there's a case submission form at thevanishedpodcast.com. If you'd like to contact me, there's a page and a discussion group on Facebook. I'm on Twitter at thevanishedpod and also on Instagram. If you enjoy this show, subscribe now on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, Wondery.com, or wherever you're listening right now. Do you want to help support the show? There's a couple things that you can do. Rate and review on Apple Podcasts. Your 5-star reviews help others find the show. Another way to support The Vanished is by filling out a short survey at Wondery.com/survey. Join me next week. I'll be covering a case from Washington. Thanks for listening.
We just sit here and we talk, you know, what could have happened, you know, this and that, but there really never was a lot to go on in the beginning. And we've just kind of waited for something big to happen, a sighting, or over the years, you know, there may be some remains have been found somewhere close by. And that would kind of get us down thinking, oh my gosh, that's probably him. We'd go out there and then they'd come to find out, no, they, you know, found the identification of the person. It wasn't Keith. So there's been a lot of, you know, ups and downs, but there really hasn't been any true sightings of him or any indication to make us believe he's still alive. And we just feel like maybe now, I've seen in cases, they say like after this length of time that maybe somebody was scared at the beginning. They didn't want to say something that they knew, but you know, over the years, they feel more comfortable talking about it when they get, you know, re-interviewed or something. So we're just hoping maybe a tip will come in that somebody did see something 21 years ago, did hear of something, did know of something, but for some reason, you know, they just didn't want to say it at the beginning, but that they'll come forward now. Just help us to get something to go on so we can do more of an investigation and find out what happened. But until we have something, you know, there's just not much to go on.
Please help me find my son. I'm pleading with anybody. I'm just telling you, I want to find my son. I want to know where he's at. I want to know what happened to him, and I want to know why.
Whether you're working out, walking, or running errands, Audible can help you keep your heart rate up month after month with their pulse-pounding collection of thrilling audiobooks that you can't hear anywhere else. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog, which includes thousands of titles. This month, check out the Audible original, The Space Within. It's a chilling 8-part story about a psychiatrist, Dr. Maddie Weil, voiced by Academy Award winner Jessica Chastain, who is tasked with unlocking the memories of a child who went missing for 7 hours. Maddie soon discovers that there are more who have faced similar experiences, and the truth of what is happening to them may impact the fate of humankind. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500. That's audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500.
Welcome to the small town of Chinook, where faith runs deep and secrets run deeper. In this new thriller, available exclusively on Wondery Plus, religion and crime collide when a gruesome murder rocks the isolated Montana community. Everyone is quick to point their fingers at a drug-addicted teenager, but local deputy Ruth Vogel isn't convinced. She suspects connections to a powerful religious group. Enter federal agent V.B. Loreau, who has been investigating a local church for possible criminal activity. The pair form an unlikely partnership to catch the killer, unearthing secrets that leave Ruth torn between her duty to the law, her religious convictions, and her very own family. But something more sinister than murder is afoot, and someone is watching Ruth. With an all-star cast led by Emmy nominee Sanaa Lathan and Star Wars Kelly Marie Tran, Chinook is available exclusively and ad-free on Wondery Plus. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.